You're listening to the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 36, recorded Sunday, May 6, 2012. Google Currents. In this episode, my special guest is Will Kiefer. He's the senior iOS engineer in charge of Google Currents. Will tells us why UI WebView isn't all that bad and has some amazing performance tips for us with which to tame it. You should make lots of notes and you will feel like you visited a lab at WWDC and had your brain supercharged. Hi, welcome to another episode of the Coconetics Podcast. Today, it happened again. My MacBook Air is still has this problem again that it shuts down by itself, and so I couldn't really prepare anything on there. I've now set up my standby Mac. I have an old iMac that I set up with Audio Hijack and Skype and so on. So that didn't leave me much time to actually prepare some news. But, well, I have a goodie for you today. You're not getting any news, but I've got with me today William Kiefer. He's a senior software engineer with Google, and he's in charge of Google Currents. And he volunteered to come on the show to talk with me about why they are using actually UI WebView so much in Google Currents. You might know from my backend story that I'm really much into Cortex. And two episodes ago, we chatted with the makers of the Simple app and how they are using the DT Rich Text Editor, which is a component that I'm selling in the Simple app. And we more or less agreed that UI WebView is bad and Cortex is the future. And now there is mighty Google who thinks that that's not the case. Or is it, Will? What's your thought on that?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. Great to be here. And yeah, so I'm actually very torn. UI WebView is powerful for a number of reasons. I also kind of hate it. And I would prefer to use Cortex when possible. So there's a variety of reasons. And
Before we get too much into that, actually, many people might not know you.
Oh, sure.
I already spent a couple of minutes with you, and I know who you are and where you come from. But maybe you could give us a quick overview. Where should somebody put you? So where geographically, or kind of give us a couple of infos about what you do.
Sure. Well, so I've been at Google for just about 2 years now, and I am working primarily out of the Cambridge, Massachusetts office. For those internationally, that's basically Boston. And there's a great Google engineering office here, doing a variety of things with books and Google Currents and Google Search and some other things. So I started at Google, and I basically came right onto the Currents project and have started off initially doing some Android work and some back-end work, and have basically been full-time doing the iOS client for the past, since we launched. And we have a small team. It's great. I think we've got like 8 people working on Currents, and it's great. So that's sort of where I am and where I come from.
Can you give us an overview? You just said the Google Currents project. Is that just this iOS app that we know, or what does this entail?
Oh, sure. So there's it's actually a couple parts. So first off, there's to normal users, there's a client app for both iOS, iPad and iPhone, as well as Android, supporting I think everything from 2.2 up. And for most people, you just download the app, and there's a whole bunch of publishers on there, The Guardian, Daily Beast, everything from news to tech to politics to design. So publishers across the globe, their content's on there. All the content is full length, and it's basically sort of like a reader client for your news. We also support adding, you know, any RSS feed that you want. Not guaranteed to be full length. That depends on the RSS feed, obviously. Let's see. Yeah, and we sync across devices. It works offline. So if you commute on the subway or on the bus or have no connectivity, it's great. Or you're on an airplane. You know, other similar apps in our space is things like Zeit or Flipboard or Pulse. It's kind of a, there's a lot of apps in this like space of sort of magazines plus plus right now. So it's a fun place to be. But the other side of it that probably a lot of people don't know if you just look at Currents is that we also have a free publishing platform. So if you go to producer.google.com, and you own content of any kind, whether it's video, audio, or written, you can go on there and publish your own content. And you can, you have full control over the HTML and CSS of how it's going to display. And then you can publish it, add Google Analytics, see who, how many people are reading, and have people subscribe and get your content that way. So it's something people don't realize, but the same tools that, you know, Forbes uses or The Guardian or whatever, are the same tools that are available to anyone for their content. So,
the typical journalist slash blogger, I might call myself something like that sometimes, would have his articles on a blog. So how do I get these from there onto your platform?
It's very easy, actually. So if you go to producer.google.com, literally the first time you show up and sign in, you'll get a little wizard that says, you know, do you have content? Enter your the name of your edition, enter your RSS feed, hit done, and you're done. You've got a basic edition with a pretty good-looking default template. You don't have to do anything to it. You can add an icon for your site, add a YouTube channel, or other feeds that you might own, or add custom articles. And then from there, you basically verify that you actually own that content through kind of standard Google site verification. And then you can hit publish. And then it's live in the store, and you can pick what countries you'd like to publish your content in. And yeah, so it's pretty easy. You can get an edition up and running in just a few minutes.
Well, I should try that.
Yeah, I think actually your content would be great because you've got a great blog.
Well,
you've got a lot of an audio podcast, and you know.
bracket, open, I did.
Oh, you did.
But you don't support Safari.
Oh, I know, and you know, honestly, it's not that we don't support Safari. It's we've got a small team, and so we just haven't had time to verify that Producer works well on all the other browsers, but it's definitely coming. Mm-hmm. It's just the size of our team kind of limits how many things we can do. We want to do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But So unfortunately, if you don't have Chrome, you'd have to install Chrome. But once you do, I think it should work in Chrome frame too if you're
It work as it is, as both of these browsers use WebKit?
Oh, it does. It does. There's a few. We knew of a few bugs here and there, and honestly, it's just we got to fix them, and then we'll open it up. Mm-hmm. So, awesome. So I apologize for getting denied on Safari.
You mentioned Flipboard. Mm-hmm. Is there any one or two things that you say that Google Currents has over a leg up on Flipboard?
A lot of people like do direct comparisons, and I think we're a little bit different. I love Flipboard personally. I love Zeit, and I think that Flipboard is focused on streams you already have, like your Twitter stream or your Facebook stream, and getting that content to you in a nice, like beautiful, readable form. And I think we're sort of more on the publisher side of things, where you're subscribing sort of more to magazines or newspapers or, you know, blogs that you enjoy and reading that way. I think the thing that we do differently is that we open up our publishing platform to everybody. So anyone can publish with us, which is great. And technically anyone can publish with Flipboard because I think they take RSS feeds and obviously Twitter streams. But it's just sort of a different approach because we were really happy to open up our content.
Well, I think normal people like me don't have access to this. They have a special paginated thing that with a big logo at the top and customized ads. And I think you only get that if you are like a professional publisher.
I believe that's true. Yeah. Otherwise, they have to fall back on a variety of things if their RSS feed isn't full length or they don't have the rights to those sites, which is, you know, which is the right thing to do because, you know, you don't want to reformat someone's content without their permission.
No. I mean, if you go on Flipboard, there are some, they have some certain partners. And if you view the contents of their partners, it doesn't look like the normal Flipboard pages, but it's specifically laid out, multi-column layout with, you have some multiple pages, and then on page 3, there might be a full page ad.
Exactly, yeah. And like The Verge is an example, or I believe Engadget is a partner. They've got a number, and The Guardian. They must have access. I don't know the details, but I'm guessing that you know, obviously they have a platform similar to ours where you can customize the content. And
but what you're saying is I don't need to be somebody special to also have those kinds of features available for me.
You have full control. We actually, you have a couple options. So the basic option is to use our sort of column layout engine to paginate your content into nice columns. But you can turn that off and you can just own the whole HTML yourself and paginate yourself or do, you know, whatever you want to do. And JavaScript is available. So there's been some interesting things people have done. I know there's a edition called 101 Cookbooks where they have some basic like recipe calculators built into the articles so that if you're reading it and you need to change it up, they use JavaScript just to make some basic calculators for people.
Sort of like widgets.
Exactly. And so what we've done is we basically, it's full HTML5 and CSS, but we've added a few special fields, special tags of our own, things like gloop or gfield or glink. They're all documented on Producer, but essentially that lets you sort of auto-generate divs or content or links based on what's in your feed. So you can write one template for your RSS feed that, let's say you always know you have some link at the bottom. You want to put a nice link to your original page at the bottom of every article. We have like a glink tag for that. So you can put that in there and style it at the bottom of every article. And then our template system will basically just fill in the right stuff for you. So it's pretty powerful. There's a few editions that are really doing it with Forbes, especially. It has done some great templates. And I know the Daily Beast has done some great templates. So people are kind of doing neat things.
Well, there's one thing that I've got this open in front of me. And one thing that I noticed that I found odd, I clicked on the link for Scoble. And you said it's all like published and so. But there's one, for example, here in front of me, for those who are ... shared by Robert Scoble. And then it has a word in there that's clearly from some Facebook sign up link. So it do you some sort of scraping there if articles are shared, or where does this come from? Is this that Scoble uses some different way to get his content into his feed?
Yeah, so we actually we support a variety of streams, not just RSS, but one of them is a Google Plus stream. So that's Robert Scoble's Google Plus stream, and when he shares a link, we go out and grab a snippet of, you know, the content he's linked to and provide a link to it to show that. So I'm guessing that's what you're seeing. I'd have to pull out.
Yeah, well, if you tap on it, you see something like shared via Google Plus for those who see original article, and if you go to this, it opens a web page.
Oh, the actual web view.
It's a Facebook page.
Oh, yeah. He probably linked. He just had some recent articles where he had a comment banned on Facebook, and so he's been posting a lot about that. So he probably linked directly to Facebook. Oh, yeah. I'm looking at exactly. So he just shared a link to his friend's Facebook page. So that's why you're seeing that. We have an in-app, you know, UI web view for any links that are outbound. Mm-hmm. And then there's a button on the right to open in Safari.
Could it be that this is even auto-translated for me? Because there is some...
Yeah, so if you... The little book icon on the bottom left, we support Google Translate for almost any content. So you can press the little book icon. And then is there a little globe in the menu yes. that comes up? If you press that, you can switch to your preferred language. And we'll auto-run all the content through Google Translate for that edition. Which is great. So if you find a great article or a great edition, but it's in French, you can translate it to, you know, whatever your local language is and read the content that way. So, and we store that on a per edition level. So,
Cool. So I can read everything in every language.
Exactly. And in settings, you can go and change your preferred language to whatever you like. It, by default, we pull it off of your iOS system language.
Nice. Now, okay, that's all great. I actually got you already released it back last year, but only for the United States. Mm-hmm. And I took notice of Google Currents for the first time when you now had your was it international or European launch?
Full international, worldwide.
Full international. And the first thing that I noticed and I tweeted about was that apparently Google Currents is being really, how do you say, artful in hiding the fact that it's using UI web views everywhere. So heavily customized UI web views to display the whole thing. And so that's what I have you here now with me. Can you give us a bit of behind the scenes? What kind of work you needed to do on to tame UI web views like that?
Sure.
Because, So
stepping back just very briefly, the reason we went with UI web views in certain parts of the UI is sort of twofold. One is that we're cross-platform, so we are Android and iOS, and actually we are also on the web, because if you are on producer.google.com, you'll get a full preview of sort of what your edition will look like on a device. And so that allowed us to use some JavaScript for various layout things across all the platforms. And being a small team, that was like sort of an obvious choice that was a really good benefit. The huge trade-off is obviously that UI web views on iOS are nowhere near as fast or as easy to work with as other views. And trying to have them alongside native views and not look completely out of place is, is a bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. So I think your question is sort of, what are some of the strategies I used to make it feel faster? Yeah, so there's a few things. So in the general case, I do some pretty aggressive caching of the web views. So what I found after doing some profiling was that absolutely the slowest part of the UI web view was parsing JavaScript. So depending on how much JavaScript you have, that can take on the order of 1 to 200 milliseconds to load up a web view and just parse jQuery, for instance. Mm-hmm. And so what I end up doing is I have a cache of web views that I will reuse, where when they're pulled out of the cache, I end up clearing the body of everything and then adding new content to it, which just shaves off 100 milliseconds basically every time we have to show a web view.
So let me get this straight. So you have a web view where you have some JavaScript already primed or cached or somehow, and you just replace the content?
Exactly. So I actually have a UI web view subclass, which I know according to the docs is a bit of a no-no, but it's actually not mucking with much of the UI web view internals. It's mostly the subclass is mostly for my own convenience methods. But yes, so when we create, anytime I create one, I check the cache to see if there's one there and basically have a prepare for reuse, essentially, much like, UI table view cell or something, which will get the web view back in a state. Now that can be dangerous, obviously, because the JavaScript state from one article, you don't want it to mess with the state from a previous article. So we do our best to clear the state as best we can. And that just is the parsing of JavaScript.
So which is... how do you not run out of memory all the time? I thought web views are so resource intensive. It's the first time actually ever that I hear somebody caching web views, i.e. taking more than one and keeping them in memory.
Yeah, well, so there's some pros and cons. So at any one time, currents will likely have three web views actually as part of the view hierarchy, typically the thing you're looking at and the thing before it and the thing after, whether that's an article or just a little header above our, you know, sort of tabloid views. And then I may have, you know, another one or two in the cache. And obviously I clear the cache during low memory situations, but it really depends what you do with the web view as to how much memory it takes. I did a bunch of profiling and it was quite a while back, but you know, it was on the order of, you know, maybe a megabyte, a web view, depending, iPhone or iPad. And it works out okay. Now, I have to say on iPhone, it is much less performant than where I want it to be. On iPad, it's great. But we still have like some rendering web view performance issues on iPhone, which are actually should be, like, just kind of hit a big fix for that. So hopefully in the next version, it'll get much better on iPhone. But yes, okay, well, so that's one thing. Caching is one thing, and it's doable. I think you just have to be kind of smart about it and make sure to do profiling. One tip to note, remember, is that when you just use, I know I always forget the names, but when you're using instruments to track your memory usage, the default memory tracker does not include sort of your render graphics, like your actual core graphics memory that's used by the system. So you want to use the like VM tracker if you're really looking at how much memory your views are taking up, because that'll reveal some surprising things.
Yeah, well, I think the regular object allocations don't show the backing store for the rendered layers.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a couple other web view tips. Is one is when you change the frame of a web view, that can often lead to like a pretty big lag. And I forget what it was, but I changing the frame could easily be tens of milliseconds on a UI web view. So we tend to not change the frames very often. I also on larger web views will use a clipping superview that's the size of the screen as its superview, so that Core Graphics doesn't try to keep the whole UI web view, you know, rendered layer in memory. So often what you'll see as a very sort of wide web view will be clipped to just the screen width, which helps immensely. And then the other big sort of performance chunk is obviously the bridge between native code and JavaScript. So I don't know, you know, how much you've played with that, but and for listeners who haven't done too much of this, basically you have a synchronous way to talk from Objective-C to JavaScript via execute, you know, JavaScript or string by evaluating JavaScript string or whatever it is, and but it has a 10-second timeout. So you typically what I'll do is do a set timeout in there so that call is actually very short, and then the subsequent actual JavaScript that's being invoked is done sort of on the next pass through the JavaScript run loop. But the hard part is actually communicating back from JavaScript to Objective-C, and we actually, if there's sort of a good tip we found, is that typically what people do is they'll mess with window.location. They'll set it to some string, or window.location.hash. They'll set it to some string so that they can catch that on the web view delegate side of things. So basically they'll catch that and they'll basically put some special text in the string to let the native code know what it should do. And we make extensive use of that. But the one trick that we found is that there's often quite a lag when you set window.location.hash in the UI web view. It may be, you know, many milliseconds before you get your UI web view delegate method to let you know the should. I can look up the names. They're all blanking me now.
Yeah, they should one.
Exactly. Let me pull that up.
There's only one that's beginning with should.
Exactly. Should.
Should load something.
Yeah, should start load with request navigation type, that one. Essentially, what I found was that if you add a hidden little iframe in your UI web view and then set the iframes window.location.hash, you get that notification much quicker than the standard window.location.hash. And I'm not sure why that is. I'll put that in the random hack category, but we use that extensively to sort of speed up, because as our layout engine is running, it'll notify the native code how many, pages it's done, so that we can indicate how many pages it is, and the native code knows how big to make it, etc.
So you're doing all the pagination and layouts in JavaScript in the web view.
Exactly. And that's the reason we do that is we can use the same exact layout engine across our platforms. And yeah, so that's what we do. And that's sort of that's a good speed bonus. But that bridge is the trickiest part if you're initially starting to play with web views, is trying to get that in a that you can communicate back and forth. And it makes the layout engine, honestly, a bit more challenging, since every call back to native code is going to, by necessity, be asynchronous. So
But can you do sensible layouting in HTML? Do you know how much space certain text needs to create a new column or stuff like that?
well, so that's actually the part of the wonderful part about using it, is that putting some content in a div, and then you can measure how much how high that div is, and then where you need to put your next code. And we push a lot of data into the web view, such as screen size and some other, and the content itself, so that the JavaScript can have some data about how to lay it all out.
But
But yeah.
I can do that too. I've got in my core text thing. I once I get the attributed string, which I can create from HTML. I can put that in a layout frame, and basically this tells me also how much space is needed for
Oh yeah.
it, and where does the string end, so that I can start another column, say by the same way.
Oh, there's no question you can do all that in core text, and all the link detection. The thing that you can't do very easily is support, arbitrary JavaScript by publishers, or arbitrary CSS, honestly. I mean, because for every CSS element, I'm sure you have to battle with implementing, all the various things. And I don't know if you ever did like WebKit animations or something. It would probably be a big headache. So we have some publishers actually using all that stuff. So kind of re-implementing HTML layout, and not trying to limit what publishers could do with it, it was a bit too large of a problem. And I know DT Core Text, there's like a subset of CSS that's supported, correct? And you'd have to do that. I mean, it's otherwise you're literally just re-implementing, a native browser, which is a daunting problem. I prefer to Core Text. So in all the other views, so if you look at sort of a section of content, there'll be little tabloid views with just like a headline and a snippet. It's all Core Text.
Oh, wow.
So everywhere else that is not by necessity a UI web view, I always opt for Core Text when possible.
Say, did you ever consider actually not taking UI web view, but going one level deeper and compiling WebKit with your own how you need it? Because there you
Yeah.
would get, or did you think, well, certainly that would never be approved by Apple.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting concept, but because basically if you want to run JavaScript, you're going to be doing it in UI web view, and I didn't it's a risky bet. I'm not sure what they would do with something like that, honestly. And just by the sheer sort of size of the project, being like sort of a one man team on this. It was I had to cut any possible corners I could to get it done. So so I went with UI WebView for that reason.
Are you not speaking directly into your microphone? You sound a bit muffled.
Is this better now?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, so let's see. So,
well, you were going through some performance tips, and you mentioned caching web views. You mentioned the frame of the web view. You wouldn't want to change that. The fourth I've got in my notes, I'm taking many notes here, was that you communicate with the outside Objective-C by means of a small iframe where you change the hash as opposed to changing the location of the entire document, which is slower.
Exactly. And I honestly don't know the implementation details of why that is, but just by profiling it, it tended to notify the native code much, much quicker. And so I sort of ended up doing a very generic there's a JavaScript method called OBJ or OBCJ or OBJC underscore message send, mimicking the Objective-C runtime so that we can just send arbitrary messages back from JavaScript to native code via that.
So basically you wrote your own Objective-C script.
There's a small bit of JavaScript there that manages a message queue that sends things back.
And I take it in Objective-C, then you are changing these into NS invocations and executing them.
Yeah, well, I've got sort of a there's sort of a defined bridge interface back to native code that we share across Android and iOS. Things like, for instance, if you tap on a picture, mm-hmm. we will open up a native photo viewer. Mm-hmm. And so there's like a very specific call to do that, or opening up a link, or doing, we support cross-linking to other, you know, sections or other articles. And so there's sort of a small set of defined things we do. So I don't do an arbitrary NS invocation or anything. Oh,
okay. But you said something like Objective-C execute, that wouldn't work on Android, right?
No, yeah, there's a special, because on Android, actually, you have a synchronous native JavaScript to Java layer that you can have. And so you don't actually really need that. I had to write a little bit of an extra layer to do that communication via the iframe location hash. On Android, it's actually a bit easier. Just like on Mac, I believe there's a bridge you can call back into Objective-C.
Uh-huh. So that's probably one of the top things on your wish list for Apple.
Maybe. I don't mind that, because once there's a bit of a layer, honestly, the top of my wish list would be the, you know, just in time compiler support for UI web views within any application. Obviously, I don't think that's going to happen for sandboxing reasons. But the JavaScript performance is the hardest part about using a UI web view that has any bit of JavaScript in it.
JavaScript much, much slower than in Safari, say?
It is, because, or at least on iOS 5, they have the V8 JavaScript just-in-time compiler support, but it's not available for UI web view use, because it requires, you kind of have to mark that application as having special access to rewrite read-only memory. Mm-hmm. And so it's not come to other apps yet. So it's a challenge, because you don't really get the advantage of that. That would be my top wish list.
I remember seeing somewhere that iAds, which are made in HTML5, get the benefit of this extra speed. So that gives us a bit of hope that this will eventually find its way into your web view as well.
That'd be great. It's interesting. Maybe they specially mark those classes or something. Yeah, that'd be wonderful. I mean, that's the hardest part about using UI web view. And also, so iOS 5 is much better. So they actually give you direct access to the UI scroll view that UI web view uses, because it's actually not a scroll view itself. It has a subclass or a subview, which is great because you have full access to like the pan gesture recognizer on the web view, scroll view, and a few other things. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to see a little bit more of that going forward, opening up some of the customization of UI WebView, because for the longest time it was a black box. Mm-hmm. You know, you throw some HTML at it and hope it renders in time. And they seem to be sort of letting people have more access. One example is if you've ever enabled scrolling on the WebView, you'll notice that there's little shadows.
I wanted to mention these. This is one of the painful things that you cannot really customize, or can you?
Well, you actually can. So, you can't customize, but it turns out they're not using CA layer shadows or anything. Those are actually, I think there's like 8 or 10 UI image views that are subviews of one of the, they're basically grandchild views of the UI web view. So if you walk the hierarchy, you can check that appearance. Because we disable scrolling on those web views, uh-huh. And so you'll never see those. But just playing with web views, there's no way to turn those off otherwise. And iOS 4, there's no way to actually touch the scroll view without sort of walking the view hierarchy too.
Yeah, well, people would go and just search for the first scroll view they find and assume that this is the one.
Exactly, yeah. Which is always a dangerous
path. Generally worked.
It did, but some of that, actually I think they changed the hierarchy a bit in iOS 5 actually, so some of those hacks don't always work on across the two platforms there. In general, like there's some great things about you using UI WebView. You know, we get all the copy text and text selection and all that comes for free. We allow publishers to basically do whatever they want, not limited by us implementing, you know, WebView features, at the severe trade-off that it's, you know, it's like trying to code a UI with like a, you know, one hot hand tied behind your back, just because it's a much bigger challenge to make it feel okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you have anything else on? Tips for improving the performance of your WebView?
I found that recently I was playing with it a bit, and I found actually that it tends to perform much better if you keep a WebView frame no larger than the actual main screen frame. Because once you grow it a little bigger, you tend to get a little bit of jankiness scrolling, and I have a feeling that, you know, there's sort of a buffer size potentially that they sort of assume to not usually be larger than one screen that ends up causing issues. But other than that, I have to say it's UI WebView can be a pleasure to use, actually. Like, you know, you can set transforms on it and do all sorts of things, and once it's been rendered, it performs just as well as any other UI view, which is really nice. So with some future versions and actually, you know, doing that, it is nice.
Marco Arment from Instapaper mentioned that he's using also web views for display of the pages, and to get the paging animation result, what he does is render layer in context of mm-hmm. your web view, have that as an image, and then animate that. So
yep.
From one page to another. Do you have tricks like this in Google Currents as well?
No, I don't have that, but that's a good trick. I actually have basically the web view is hosted in a UI scroll view, which is actually also something you're not really supposed to do, but scrolling's disabled on the web view. So I'm managing sort of the web view frame that way. So when you swipe between pages, there's no trickery like that. So that's why you can get like your standard.
So you have one web view per page?
No, there's one web view per article. But the sort of theoretical frame of the web view is very wide, is exactly as many pages as the article is. And then I basically, using a small like clipping UI view over it, as you swipe, you're swiping a UI scroll view that's moving the frame of the very wide web view under you.
My mind has just been blown. So you basically have a web view that's sized to fit the entire article.
That's what I currently have. I may not always have that. I've been doing some investigations, but yes, currently. So let's say you have a three-page article. So the width of the actual UI web view is going to be like, 2300 pixels, so three times the screen width. But there's a small UI view over it that is clipping that so that the actual render buffer is not nearly that large, because the process will get killed if you use that much memory. And so at
And do you use a tiled layer for that or just regular CL layer?
just regular. I use no tiled layer support here. So imagine you have a web view that's three sizes of the iPad wide, and then there's a scroll view on top of that, and you're just scrolling that web view, basically. Fixed width web view.
And you find that having your own scroll view with a wide clipped your web view is faster than just having one web view that's as large as the screen and have the scrolling in there.
No, well, so I've been playing with that a lot. So part of it was because we started on iOS 4 and there wasn't really a, you weren't really allowed to mess with the scroll view of the web view, which I kind of needed to do. I needed to act as its delegate, and I needed to actually subclass it so I could, so I needed my own subclass of UI scroll view to get at some certain things. And we don't just use web views, we have a variety of other sort of native views we use, and so I had to support both. And that's why I went with that method. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. It's something I may change in the future. But it works. It works fine, and it gave me full control over a scroll view that I owned versus one that I had to traverse a view hierarchy to muck with. And because you couldn't, until iOS 5, they didn't give you any access to the gesture recognizers that are on the UI web view scroll view, and I couldn't subclass it or replace it. So basically, I kind of didn't have an option for iOS 4. But in the future, I may change that depending on things. So I would recommend keeping it at the frame, the size of the screen, and no larger. But it does work.
Wait, no, now I'm a bit confused because I think I see a contradiction there. You said you have a web view that's three screens large, but it shouldn't be larger than one screen. How can you have both?
That not to be larger for other people, but it is three screens wide, but there is a UI view over it that is only a little more than one screen wide that clips to bounds so that it's not going to render the things you're not looking at, basically.
And you probably then have to move that as you scroll so
Yeah.
that it always stays in the visible area.
Exactly. And that's how we keep the memory use from exploding.
There's another thing that you tweeted that intrigued me very much, also related to performance. You mentioned that you have a special way how you speed up loading of images,
Oh, yeah.
not by the regular NSURL cache, but via actually going directly into the protocol. So can you tell us about that a little bit?
Probably the best tip if you ever have a web view. It's great. And I actually learned about it. I was listening to a 5x5 podcast with Dan Benjamin and Marco, and they were talking about NS URL protocol, which is something I honestly wasn't that familiar with. And the documentation is a bit sparse, so it's sort of not obvious what it does when you first look at it. But essentially, it's fantastic. So stepping back, the normal way or a very common way that people would use local images in a UI web view would be to make an NS URL cache subclass. And iOS lets you set that set your own subclass as the global URL cache. And people would do is there's one method in there that people would tend to override that is basically saying cached, response for URL or something similar. And that's supposed to be a quick lookup by, the URL connection stuff and by the web view to say, oh, hey, do I have this thing cached already? And what people would do is they would use that as a hook to basically say, oh, yes, hold on. And then you could synchronously download something or pull it off of, your local cache and serve up a fake URL response with that data. And that's what I did in Currents 1.0, and it was pretty common. The big downside of that is that access to that URL cache is typically serial. So the UI web view, it's supposed to be a quick lookup to say, oh, is this thing cached, yes or no? By loading up your image there or potentially having to download it or something like that, you're basically blocking all the other image loads in your web view. And so the alternative method, which I learned about, is basically NS URL protocol. And what that is it's just a class to that you're supposed to subclass to provide support for any old protocol. You could, do CoConnex colon slash slash and do your own protocol. But it's not just for that. You can actually just do some subset of another protocol like HTTP. And so you write a subclass of this, let's say, my shared URL cache or something like that. Or sorry, my URL protocol or something, cache URL protocol. There's about five methods you override in that, and I'll look them up to actually get the name. Attachment URL protocol. But the most important one up front is essentially the can init with request. So anytime the web view or something is gonna go about to go download some URL, it will call all the registered URL protocols in the system to say, hey, can you handle this? Hey, can you handle this? And the best thing is you register your subclass and it calls it in reverse registration order. So when you register your own protocol, you get to intercept all those before the standard system HTTP handler. So you basically look and you look at the URL and say, oh, that's an URL that I have in my cache, and you just return yes. And then you basically get a start loading and a stop loading call. And on start loading, you can go ahead and pull the data from your cache or, go download it or whatever. And there's a property on your subclass called the client, which you just update with your progress. So at the bare minimum, they call start loading for you. You load up your image, you call, self client URL protocol did load data and URL protocol did finish loading, and you're done. And the huge benefit there is that that will be called concurrently by the web view because it's going to go and download, I don't know, two or three images at a time potentially. So that gives your cache a chance to do those concurrently, and it ends up just feeling a lot faster because if you do have to download one, you're not going to block the rest of your local image loads doing that. And I do this in Currents, and I not only do it for images, but I'll do it for the JavaScript resources on the page as well. So it's a great class. It's a little opaque when you first look at it, but there's five methods you override, and once you sort of it's really not a lot of code. I think I have 120 lines of code or something for our attachment loading. So it's great, and I highly recommend it for anyone.
And do you also have to return some NS URL response?
No, you don't. There's two other methods that called canonical request for request, and request is cache equivalent, and those are essentially trying to map to basically say, hey, is this request the same as the one that you already are handling? And they use that to sort of, to make the same variations, whether a relative string or a fully qualified URL or something. You can just, say yes whether those are equivalent or not. But that's it, really. Honestly, once they call start loading, it's sort of up to you to update the self client with your progress, and that's it.
How do you keep your cache? Do you have a local core data database or some SQLite database or?
Core Data. We use Core Data exclusively for all the data except for images. Now, in iOS 5, they added an amazing Core Data entity, I think, flag where you can tell Core Data to store this thing externally for you, which is pretty awesome because then you could actually have one database with all your images and your metadata. I haven't played with that yet because we're still supporting iOS 4. So what we do is all our data is in Core Data, but the actual image cache is something I wrote separately.
So you've got the local file paths or URLs in your database and just load the images separately.
Exactly. And I end up keeping them organized by the edition. So let's say you subscribe to, Robert Scoble, and then when you hit unsubscribe, there's one local cache folder with all the images associated with that. So I can just delete them all in one go.
So do you also have one database per edition?
I don't. The database is shared across everything. Actually, I love, so I'll give you the 2 minutes on how I like to organize web-based apps with Core Data. Is what I tend to do is I have two managed object contexts, one the UI thread, and the whole UI is driven off of that object context. And then on a background thread, I'll be potentially syncing new data or deleting things or whatever, modifying the database in a separate background managed object context. And then there's the managed object context did save notification that gets fired off if I save the background object context. And then the foreground one can merge those changes in and the update, and then the UI just reflects those updates automatically. It's a bit tricky for people to do like cross-thread. Core Data is not particularly an easy task, but if you really separate it and just say, the UI is basically read-only all the time, and this background context will do your updates, it works out really great. And
Do you know about this in iOS 5? There's a additional possibility with sort of de dependent. I don't recall the exact term.
Object context or dependent. Yeah, it looks wonderful actually. I haven't looked too much into it, but what it's great for is let's say you have some sort of, it's great for basically a scratch pad. So you have your main object context. Let's say someone hits edit on, I don't know, like a contact or something, and they make some changes. You can make that in a child object context. And then if they hit save, great, you hit save, and those and Core Data on iOS 5 will propagate those changes sort of for you up to the main object context. Or you hit cancel and you just throw away that one. And it's great as sort of a scratch pad concept. And it saves you the work basically of just piping that managed object context did save notification work. So it sort of simplifies that same concept for people. Which looks nice. And they also have a much better block-based UI for doing object context queries, which looks fascinating, but I haven't quite used it yet. But yeah, so there's some good Core Data improvements. It's a
So how far down the iOS versions do you support, and when will you stop supporting the oldest ones?
We do 4.0 and up. I have no immediate plans to change that. We've still got a lot of users that are using. There's a lot of people still on 4.3, and at some point, it's likely, when iOS 5 is. I mean, it is everywhere already, but I don't have a quite enough compelling reason to cut off iOS 4 just yet, and so I'm just going to keep it around for the time being until it sort of gets to a point where the advantages of keeping it around are not as good as the advantages of moving on.
Well, I found on this project that I now have a hot phase on, we took out iOS 3 support, and by this we gained block-based animations, Arc, GCD. So that was very many compelling reasons to actually have iOS 4 as the minimum.
Yes, exactly. And same way, I when I did Xcode new project on Google Currents a while ago. I made it minimum iOS 4 from the get-go because I honestly couldn't program without blocks anymore. It's just a wonderful feature. So.
Well, iOS 5, I found two reasons so far personally why I would want to use that. One, if you have container view controllers that are really having a specific UI that you couldn't get otherwise. And the other one being the external file storage support for Core Data. Because I did play around with that quite a bit, and it's actually quite fabulous because it automatically determines by the size of the data whether it saves it in the database or whether it makes an external reference. So if it's, I think, less than 100K or so, it will save it in the database. But if it's larger, then at the same space where the data blob would go, it just saves a GUID in there. And in the library caches folder, you get a folder that says a file being saved by name of your app. And inside this folder, you can briefly see appear a file with this GUID. And then it moves it to some hidden location. So if you do, you wouldn't see it then anymore on iOS, but if you go to this folder in the simulator and do a ls minus la to see the hidden folders, then there's a hidden folder where it keeps all these images.
Oh, interesting. Do you know if they split that folder up into subfolders once you get a lot of those
I
files?
didn't look into that so much, but I don't think they need to because the files are based on GUID. And there is no from what I saw, I had a look with SQLite 3 in and the table, and there I could only see a GUID.
Oh,
So
interesting.
I think what happens is that it will look into this field, and if it's got the size of a GUID and it's got a GUID in there, then it will go to this folder that it knows where it is and just load the file with this name. And otherwise, it assumes that the data in there is the actual data.
Yeah, that's great. That's a wonderful feature. The only, and I love Core Data. The only hard part is if you know you want to delete a lot of stuff, Core Data is sort of annoying because you got to pull it all in and then delete the items. So
Well,
even if I had iOS 5 for images, I don't know. I'm not convinced I would use Core Data to store that data. I'm not sure.
the hint that Markus Sara gave me at NS conference
Uh-huh.
was data that can be easily replaced or that you might want to delete as opposed to user data, so what is read and so on, you should put into a different configuration. In Core Data, you can have your tables in multiple configurations, and you can have one persistent store per configuration. So you would put all these image cached things into basically their own persistent store,
Oh,
and
interesting.
then you can easily get rid of these.
Oh, that's a great tip. I like that.
The one thing that you can't do, you can't have a link or relation from one configuration to another. But if say you have a primary key like an article ID in one configuration, then you can have the same article ID in the other one and thus have your link.
Oh, that's
You can't
cool.
have a direct relationship where you load the managed object and then you have an NS set with the dependent entities, but you can do a fetch for the ID and then you've
By
got it from
ID.
there.
Oh, that's great. That's a good tip. The other iOS 5 thing that I sort of drool over is the in UI scroll view delegate. They added the what was it? It was the where was it? The did let's see, target. Yeah, that's right. The scroll view will end dragging with velocity target content offset. Have you seen that method yet?
No. So
It's wonderful.
it
It
tells you
lets
where it's going to end.
Yeah, and it's an in-out parameter, so it tells you where it's going to end, and you can modify it to end at a different place. So it's wonderful if you have, like, a gallery of items or something, and you're scrolling, and you always sort of want it to land with one centered. You know your velocity, you know where it's going, and you're allowed to modify the end. So,
Recently, I had the situation where I was thinking how I could achieve that because I would do it like when the scrolling ended, I would then scroll this missing distance, but that would look weird because it will
yeah.
stop and then start and stop again. But
And
with
it takes
this,
quite a long time. The default deceleration rate, that last couple pixels, takes a long time before you actually get the did end decelerating call, which is frustrating. Yeah, so yeah, otherwise people would have to sort of do it manually or try to calculate the velocity themselves. So that's maybe my favorite iOS 5 addition.
yeah,
So.
well, let's leave it at that. We have spent an hour now on all the optimizations. The thing that still burns on my mind to ask you about is how is it to be working on iOS stuff while being at Google? Isn't that a conflict of interest?
No, it's actually wonderful. Google's like very, very Mac friendly. I mean, almost every, pretty much every mobile app, I can't think of any exceptions, is that's available on Android is also available on iOS to some extent. There's not necessarily always feature parity, but Google's very dedicated to staying with iOS and staying with the Mac platform. And everyone I know uses a Mac for their laptop every day, pretty much. Well, that or a Chromebook. And there's a lot of people who love iOS there. And it's actually sort of a it's unique because the majority of people at Google aren't doing iOS. They're doing either their web or Android or Chrome or something. And so it's really fun because there's a small set of people, but you can have a lot of impact. For instance, I had some help from another developer on my team early on, but like basically I'm the only developer on this product, and it's great. I get to work on my own iOS app, but for Google. So I love
Well,
it.
that's another thing you keep mentioning all the time, that your team is so small and you are all by yourself. How does this fit with working for a big company like Google? Are they not giving you enough resources? Don't they hire enough iOS developers so that you don't have to just be by yourself?
Well, first of all, I kind of like it, so I wouldn't blame wouldn't blame Google. But no, it's just our team. We sort of it feels a bit like us, like we're at Google, but it feels a bit like a startup, which is really nice. And there are obviously more resources available, but right now, like we're sort of at a good size, and we like our team have, feels like we really have control of the product, and it's kind of wonderful. So, but yeah, I mean, there aren't like there's not too many iOS developer. There's not that many iOS developers at Google. So, it's
Well, what's your personal opinion? Should there be more? Should Google hire more, or are they hiring?
Oh, they're definitely hiring. There's definitely, I don't know. I think it depends. I'd like to see. It's tough. I'd like to see more, but I'm biased, obviously. But there's plenty. I mean, there's a lot of great Google open source projects, and there's a lot of people who've been Mac developers for a long, well before the iPhone came out, that are still at Google. And it's wonderful to have them around because they've been around forever. They're great sources of information. Yeah, I don't know. I love iOS. I love programming for it, so I'm always happy to see more
But
development.
one thing I can imagine, if I were in your shoes, I would constantly be afraid that Google one day would say, okay, that's it for iOS. We are so successful with Android, we don't need that anymore. So you are all laid off. Or don't you see that ever a possibility? Because Google is r relatively agnostic, and if there's people on a platform that are going to support it.
Yeah, I would I would disagree with that. I would say that like a Google user is platform independent. You know, you're a search user, you're a Plus user or a Gmail user or what. And it honestly doesn't matter what platforms you're using. I mean, Google, the products are all supported across all the desktop OSs. They're very Linux friendly. Android and iOS, but pretty much all the services are available. So I don't see that happening. I don't see them stopping any development anytime soon. But so, you know, so that this is all my personal. Safe. It's all my personal opinion, obviously not that of my employer. But I feel safe. I'm happy, and I like what I'm working on. Objective-C is a joy to use. So,
That about nicely wraps it up. We've talked about an hour now. Will, it's been a total pleasure for me. I felt like I've been in a lab with an Apple engineer making lots of notes.
You're too nice.
And lots of cool tips that you share with us. So thank you for being on the show. And I guess I'll see you at WWDC, won't I?
Oh, unfortunately, first of all, thank you for having me. It's been really fun to talk, and hopefully maybe we can do it again. Maybe if there's some other topic for the future. But I'm actually not going to WWDC this year. I wish I was, but my family, we're actually moving across the country. We're going back to Seattle. So during that time, I'll be frantically moving across the country. And so fortunately this year, I will not be there, but next year.
Next year. We're in for this for the long haul, so we'll definitely meet each other. So
exactly.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And dear listeners, thank you. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I took many good notes, and if you didn't, it's a podcast. You can listen to it over and over again, and I think you will feel much smarter if you listen to it for a couple of times. So that's it for this week's edition of the Coconetics podcast, and I hope to be seeing you